This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is from West Virginia, Ethan Fisher, and he's going to read to you from his new book and from his new manuscript. Let's have an opening poem, Ethan.
Nice to be here, Grace. This is a book you helped me deliver, as it were, and let me begin with a poem called Earliest, from Beached in the Hourglass. It's about my family. I guess it was sitting on snowy steps with a little brother on my lap, porch steps. We were to smile for the camera. I scowled. It was cold on the steps and a little brother I didn't need. All I could think was why. My father took the picture anyway. His cigar was out. He scowled at me and Mommy. I learned to scowl and smile from him. He had about 6 years to live. My little brother Mark had golden curls, and everyone adored him. To make it worse, he always took a perfect picture. Soon I was strictly background, a pair of pants behind the joyous blonde baby. I guess this changed. When my sister came along, she posed in her toy car or held Daddy's hand. She had Chinese hair and brave baby teeth. Mommy was a beauty, smoking. Her love was scary. Lisa came when I was 5, Mark when I was 3. We had a white dog named Dixie who smiled for all of us, wagged for years. That first snow picture has survived. Some days I feel like that, with the weight to hold and the cold steps. Other days I remember sun, immortal tan, Mark's gaze. Only Lisa and I are left. Now when she comes around, we take new pictures.
That's the voice of Ethan Fisher. And in case you think it sounds like a broadcasting voice, it does. He has a news program in West Virginia, in Harper's Ferry, and he teaches at Shepherd University. In addition to that, he has, get a load of this, an engineering degree from Cornell, cum laude major in BA from University of Pittsburgh. From the University of Michigan Law School, he has his JD, his Juris Doctorate, and from the West Virginia University and St. Mary's College, various courses. So this is a man of many voices and many interests and many poems. How does the letter of the law differ from the spirit of the law, in that the spirit of the law might be your poetry, the law of poetry? What is the language difference there?
That's quite a question, Grace. I've just been thinking about the law in writing some poems about my father, who was a lawyer, my mother too, and I wonder how to answer that. The law is beautiful language and noble. And if you could get back to the eloquence of what we're taught from the great judges, you'd be a poet right there.
Oh, that is so interesting. And so that doesn't impede you then when you go into the fields with a muse?
Well, I've been thinking of going back to the bar and hanging out my shingle, but I may just be a poet with shingles.
Now you know why we want him. Ethan is here from West Virginia, has trekked over the mountains to be with us. But we want his, first and foremost, his poetry.
Well, I want to get to that poem with the reference to the law, but this is one that won a little prize down at a writer's conference. It's called Nomenclature, and it rhymes. It's about those phrases that define like a pride of lions, and it goes like that with these categories. Nomenclature. A point of fingers, a slapping of hands, a furrow of brows, a groan of glands, a ribbon of prayer, an arrow of slings, a repose of rivers, a worm of kings, a meal of regrets, a trove of masks, a noose of guts, a truth of tasks.
That's a little different for you.
Trying forms, yeah, I'm sort of sliding back into that, if not the law.
If not the law. He teaches English literature and composition at Shepherd University and has taught at Frederick Community College, with graduate teaching also at National Lewis University in Virginia. I see this is a new manuscript.
This is a new printout on pink paper, Grace. And it's like flesh.
What is the name of this, Pink Flesh?
This one is a translation of Rilke, which I felt would be a little lead-in to a few family poems, because Rilke was brought up as a girl and his mother called him Maria, and he wore skirts, and he wrote a beautiful poem that I think I've gotten into English with the rhymes pretty well. It's called Out of Childhood by Rainer Maria Rilke, my translation. The darkening was like riches in the room wherein the boy sat hidden from the rest. When the mother entered, as in dream, one glass shivered in the silent chest. She felt how the room betrayed her and kissed her child. Are you here? Then both looked at the piano in fear. For many evenings she had done a song wherein the child felt strangely wrung. He sat quite still, his great gaze hung upon her hand, weighty with a ring, as if she went deep in snow ways, walked over the white keys.
We need to tell the audience that you are my favorite translator of Rilke. I have read one poem translated by several people in addition to Bly, even. And you, I don't know why you don't put out a book of your Rilke translations, because you get into a vein, you tap a vein into your own voice that shows up there. Have people acknowledged this enough?
Yes, too. I've been encouraged a little bit, though Rilke has many good translators. Snow is a good one. I think I can relate to Rilke's family scene. His mother was oppressive. His father disappeared, and I can key into that. Also, I live with Germans, so it's fun to have them check my work, too.
Your language is good enough? You're German?
Good enough to order breakfast, if Stephen Mitchell says he's too humble. He's a good Rilke man, too. My German is pretty good. I can talk to my in-laws, and there is maybe a final barrier with slang and such.
When you do Rilke, do you ever come up against a wall that you don't feel prepared for?
I come up against the Dueno elegies, which are so high that it's beyond language. That's the kind of barrier.
That's the title of your new book, Beyond Language. That's great for you, Ethan,
well,
because you're beyond language, and so am I. This is The Poet, The Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are so happy that Ethan made it over the mountains, through the trees, to the Library of Congress. Let's have another poem.
Okay, I was mentioning family, and this is a little something that I started in a workshop with Grace when she visited and conducted one of my classes at Shepherd University. And we got some good things from the students and from me. And what I wanted to keep is the kind of epigraph for another poem about my brother Mark, who died rather young skiing, but this is a vision of him in boyhood first. Mark. My brother on his back, with me pinning him down in dust on the long sun porch, can still spit upward in my face and take a better picture, too, blonde in black and white. So that was Mark, indomitable. And here's a kind of elegy for him that I sent out to my family. They loved it. That's what a poet can do, send a poem just to those in the know. But let's try it. It's called Score of Years, Meaning Days, for Mark. He died skiing, and those images are in here. Where did you go, and were you ready for that longer snow? Could that day match your mind, poised to ski another mountain? Touch me now, signal from inside that time still holds you forever, brother, guide. Send a dream voice, your laughter warming more of winter loss or gain. You were lightning, fond of ground we knew, Mark, let each day renew our bond.
The longer snow, the longer snow.
Yeah, he died of a heart attack. It wasn't an accident. His skiing was magnificent, and he died happy.
Doing what he loved.
Yeah.
But the longer snow is, how did that come to you?
There was a given. You know how a poem gives you a little something. I guess that's where it started, the little fuse there.
I am liking this family. I knew this family from your first book, but it seems to be coming into focus. It becomes, these snapshots are so clear. Let us have more. This is the new book, Beyond Language, by Ethan Fisher.
Yes, I brought a lot of new poems. Thanks for the help on that. I was jazzed to see Terence Hayes read an unbelievable poem about his father at the Sotto Voce, where you presided in a way. And I got a kick in the pants for writing about my father, where I've been sort of doing a series, some of them repeating myself. But this one is called Letter to a Lawyer, Father Come Home. And he died young, too.
What do you call young?
40.
That's what I call young.
So, and then I had a wonderful stepfather who lived to be nearly 100. So, Letter to a Lawyer, Father Come Home, Washington, D.C. Weak are bones of contention. He worked at the Department of Justice. Just once from justice, you could have come home before a son had to go to bed. Later, a second dad would love to travel or to labor late, just like you, Joe, the late father. Should I practice law? Time to look out a scratched window of the subway train or to save another morning's fears. You wrote me a red fox to read or to remove from a road leading home. Gaps between teeth grew light-year spaces in my memory, Joe, of you. Inhabit a butterfly to halt an amnesia. Let's come home now at last for each other. This one has a form. Each stanza gets a little shorter, but, you know, so it shows on the page a little bit.
This search for your father, is it intensifying?
Well, I'm trying to fill the gaps, even if I have to lie. I just remember certain scenes with a cigar and the snow, and, you know, that's how memory is. But there's a lot of domestic evenings missing. I have to assume he wasn't home. That's what this poem is about.
I am liking this a lot. This is Ethan Fisher. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're getting a treat, a premiere.
Shall I go again?
Let's do one more, yeah.
That's pretty much it for, I mean, I have a long one, but I want to get to something lighter.
You do many voices, and I want to move to Johnny Dime. Were you prepared to do Johnny Dime, or may I just talk about it?
Johnny Dime, the poet of crime, my alter ego. A Seamus of the 60s, and since he's Jewish, maybe a Shamus of the 60s.
Well, I first heard of you on the Rumsey Radio Hour, where you premiered Johnny Dime. I know you're just too through with it by this time, but it has made you kind of famous. And you had a whole plot, you had a whole cast of characters, and this Johnny Dime, this poet of crime, didn't actually solve many crimes, did he? I think his cat solved some.
He has a karate cat with a black pelt. Her name is Meg, forgive me. And his mother, who's a dipsomaniac, sort of modeled on my own, solves his crimes many times, but she's irascible and she turns up in the bit I could read you now if you want.
So you had a mother who was caused tumult because of a frailty, but when it was not in play, she was a concerned parent.
She was wonderful with a one-liner, and she encouraged us to be out there, and particularly with language and languages. She taught me German as a kid because she had German grandparents, and she loved to hear us be eloquent in any humble way.
Oh, I heard you tell someone she sang you German lullabies when you were a baby.
And she sang in French, too.
I do want to just pursue this for a moment, because though we have parents with wounds who stagger through life, look at the gifts we are given. She gave what she could and could give nothing more. She gave you the gift of language, so maybe dinner wasn't on time.
Exactly. And she said she wanted her children to be characters, and she certainly got her wish, all of us.
Oh, that is so interesting. I never knew that, Ethan. Well, let us go on with Johnny Dime, because he's a hottie.
Johnny Dime wears a raincoat in the shower. This kind of a guy. He packs heat. He goes around with a banana under his lapel, and he's dangerously ineffectual. But he's a poet who lives in an office above Sheets. So if you're hearing this in the Eastern Seaboard, you get the joke, because Sheets is a gas station. The office above Sheets on Route 45. The Will to Survive on Route 45. This one is in the book, Beached in the Hourglass. It's called Tooth Fairy's Wake, a Mystery, starring Johnny Dime, the poet of crime. It was the morning after fists broke my smile, black keys in the piano. On a pillow, I found breakfast, eggs, but still in the chicken. I scrambled out of bed and dressed the part, GQ meets Dog World. Phone rang. I barked, yeah, Deuce Detection, Dime speaking. A voice on the line said, you dope. Sure, honey, I said and hung up. Now my milk was chocolate and my tie was the cat's tail. Old Ma looked too pale. She burped and fed me Ripple and oatmeal. She still solved cases of scotch and murder, though Chicago cops had clubbed Ma to ghost in autumn 1968. Yeah, since then, Ma's been see-through. You see bourbon shots glow inside her, but one death didn't slow her down. Everything's alive in the right light. I drove the old car to work. My Edsel makes a car wash ad. As a hero, I'm washed up. But for 100+, you could have me tail a spouse, bodyguard a louse. As Lou Archer says, I'm a garbage collector in the moral line. Yeah, here's my card with a bullet hole, the real drop of blood. So if rogue surgeons stabbing dreams rob you of sleep, friend, phone me or else be sewn to a sheep.
Ethan Fisher as Johnny Dime. He got, the eggs were still in the chicken at breakfast time, but he scrambled out of bed. What a great voice. From that to Rilke, to form, to lyrical poetry, to the law. Tell me how many strands are within Ethan Fisher.
I'm a kind of late bloomer, Grace. I'm still trying to figure that out before I fade. And people are encouraging me, such as yourself. I do feel like another book is in being. And some interviews.
I want a book of Rilke translations. I don't care if it's a little book, a chapbook. It could be a small book, a small immortal book.
Rilke's a little old-fashioned. I think that's what I can get into. I mean, he's not entirely New Age, feel good all the time. He also wrote in French, and those poems are not available. But I try to get the rhyme and the form, and it helps me to learn my own craft.
Did he live with Rodin?
He worked as Rodin's secretary, who encouraged him to go out to museums and look at art and stop writing about himself all the time.
Did he sleep with Rodin's mistress?
I've heard you say that, Grace.
Well, you see, I'm the head of Hopper of poetry, and I actually think I did read that, actually, but we won't go there. Let's stay here. Let's stay with Ethan Fisher at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I would rather hear your poetry than about Rilke's sex life.
Well, can I read one about we're American poets, right? And they'll stop traffic for an artist in Paris, right?
Will they?
If you're Dizzy Gillespie, I heard this story, the traffic cop would stop, you know, on the Champs-Élysées, would stop the cars to let him go across. In this country, how much respect do we get? Except on your show, perhaps. But here's the American pastime. My metaphor here, this maybe doesn't work on one reading, but I want to try it. It's set in Pittsburgh, the poet as a kind of relief pitcher, you know. When the game is maybe slipping away from us and we need someone to close the closer, right? And there was a great relief pitcher in Pittsburgh in the days of Forbes Field. There's a reference to The Shadow, the old radio show. The shadow knows. The weed of crime bears bitter fruit. The shadow knows. We remember these old shows. Anyway, this is about a poet as relief pitcher. Baseball poet. Where the shadow knows. Some nights I play right field for a team that hardly knows me. Some nights I pinch hit, lift singles over second base. But some nights nobody can pitch his stuff over the plate. With my semi-Clemente arm, I'm called in as late reliever when the bullpen is empty or they run out of words on the roster, or worse, forget how to pitch to ripeness or extinction. Now the catcher squats and gives me no sign. The ump leans in as the batter waits. From the mound, my rosin bag scent restores Forbes Field youth to old owners of lint in pockets of shadow. And some nights my fastball is smoke or my curve disappears. Yeah, the shadow knows how to fill the bleachers some nights and how to finish the game.
Well, you shot that out of the park. You did. That's a great metaphor for the poet. Sometimes in the limelight, sometimes not. Your students have talked to me about you, Ethan. And I want to speak to you about
that. God bless them.
God bless them. How you love those students. I think once a long time ago I said, oh, is this your métier? Teaching is, you don't even get tired teaching. The rest of us get tired because, boy, do you love it. What do you love about it?
Oh, the to be surrounded by the energy of young people, though many of them are non-traditional students too, but to be surrounded by enthusiasm every day, or every day I'm on campus anyway, is, you don't need sleep. You can, it's just such a thrill. And what we discover together isn't in the program notes, you know? And
there was one poem that you read me from a young person. You specialize in young people off duty. That was, you don't have it with you, do you? That knocked me out. That poet wrote such a deep, penetrating poem. I couldn't believe what you got out of a young person.
You're talking about the Cummings exercise?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't bring the Cummings original, though.
That's okay. We'll just float that one and let people believe that we're telling the truth. Let me tell you guys, the man gets stuff out of young people that they didn't know they had. And in this case, you used Cummings as a template, as a mentor?
Yeah, the spring poem of Cummings, where the puddles are mud luscious and puddle wonderful, is just the best spring poem ever written, really, which is saying something. And then the kids, age 10 and 11 maybe, in the park, I teach them in the summer times for Parks and Rec, and together, mostly them, I just maybe trimmed a syllable here and there, because they're task is to keep the syllables, the lines, the look of the poem exactly. And the E. Cummings original is behind this poem by children. And they gave me permission to put it in the book. It's called In High Summer. I have a one-line poem of my own. Summer is a gold tooth in God's smile. That one got published in the magazine Ruby. I got paid for one line.
How much do they pay a line?
One magazine.
$10? Oh, a magazine?
I don't know. Okay. This is the kids writing about summer. In high summer, like a split teapot, awkward the oak trees flatten squirrels. Tim Burr, get off me, as Bob and Nancy speed driving a Land Rover green as trash can summer, when the world is squirrel glamorous, the weird young half-sister whining black and blue, Ben and Jerry painting her face, skips from checkers and Game Boy, and it's hot, and the stink-footed squirrel man hollers, sack of poo. That's poo with an H on it, folks.
That was Ethan Fisher. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I want to tell you just a little bit more about the plus part of him. He was senior editor of the Antietam Review, time-honored magazine here on the East Coast, and he has collaborated on many projects. His last book was called Beached in the Hourglass, and all you have to do is go into a bookstore and ask for it, and they will get it, because sometimes bookstores are not so cool about carrying all the titles. But if you ask for it, they'll get it for you. He has been in Wild Sweet Notes, which was 50 years of West Virginia poetry. He contributed to the Oxford Encyclopedia entry on Delmore Schwartz. He has broadcast his plays and poetry. He is a Shakespearean actor, and his work has appeared in many national publications and periodicals. And he is here with us for today. He's made the big trip just to tell you who he is and what he's doing now. How do you compare your new work with your first book?
I was just thinking about that and talking about it with a fellow poet. I don't know, I fancy I'm working harder on poems that tend to be a little longer, taking more time with them, and looking at my earlier work, if I really go back, they were short and in your face and full of energy, but I just got them out there, you know, and now I'm really, like, I feel like I've mastered some elements of the craft while I may not have that, you know, that punch sometimes. But I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for more narrative and a little more understandable poem.
You had a series of poems on the professor persona, which you are. Do you still feel tender toward any of those?
Well, yeah, I have poems in which there's a character prof. These poems are set in a shepherd-like setting, a pizza place in the campus town, in the college environment.
This is from Beached in the Hourglass, where you're allowed to go into a bookstore and request it.
This is called Prof Teaches Tragedy, and it's set in a English composition class. Prof teaches tragedy. Prof thinks Monday, English 102's young minds dance out of view. Erasing the board, he'd bless them, such students. Maelstrom, film, feed 'em, popcorn, wisdom, sell 'em dream sex, all the same, seeking lawnmower, love cable, parts for a car that costs 2 jobs and daycare, still no way to save. Bride and groom insured against everything but television slave to build pyramid with pool-deep garage to make believe America is free. But what kind of prayer helps, and what the hell's cable love? At the lectern. Let's begin with the Greek creation, tragedy, for there, in the first dramatic stadium, they hit long home runs. Hey, did the ancient Greeks play baseball? Well, thanks for the question, Hector. No, I just meant that with tragedy, the first plays seem the best before Shakespeare, so we study them. Study tragedy? Like our neighbor's son, Jason Green, lost his head in a crash. A convertible took his head clean off. Poor kid was 16. Father owned the Ford lot plus Channel 3. Lost everything. Pardon me, dear students. Your minds swim channels. You read the wind whistling in from everywhere. You speak. Chorus of the Young. Remember, we are dreaming here. Our stories will be yours some century. So, like, do not distract us now with school or college grading, dung from dinosaurs. Already we work for beans or bread. We ride the brain mowers over lawns of paradise. Our music longs to chew up your phones and eat power suits and spit up bones. Pay attention to a child, pay us minimum wage, and we'll do maximum damage. Hey, Dr. Dog, heal yourself. Extinction ain't an easy course online, despite the take-home final. Good points. For next time, class, we'll read The Back Eye about how law and order plus motherhood can backfire. See you Wednesday.
That's Ethan Fisher. Let us have a final poem.
Okay, Timing Belt. This was when my car broke down a while back, and this got in the anthology, the jazz anthology, the WPFW anthology, and got a nice review. Timing Belt doesn't destroy a Toyota, but you just have to have it repaired all day when it pops. So I got a poem out of that event. Timing Belt. The timing belt goes, snaps. The car is towed to a shop off the highway. Hours it will take to replace near New Market, Maryland. Young horses stand looking at me, image of man thrown on the backs of eyes. They pause, 6 colts led by 2 beauties. They stare between nibbles and short lopes. The equine heads turn or dip as their souls decide. Legs move them in circles of joy where the sun is proud. Still, nerves fuel part of this power to behold new animals. Still, the leaders look to me. Does he have sugar? A whip? Will he try to ride us? They step a little closer, apple memories. Around the fall field leaves refract. The light is ours. Weeds still offer mouths green chewing. Flames of October rise or crackle underfoot. Now, as if signaled, colts run, all slender engines. I've never wanted anything enough. Just as these young don't want the apple enough to break stride or risk the hand near fences, man is just another tree moving in the sky.
You've wanted apple memories, and you've given them to us. Ethan Fisher at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back. Back, we're at the Library of Congress, and we have poet Ed Zonizer as our guest. He has traveled from West Virginia to be with us. He's the author of two books, and he's going to read an opening poem. I think you're going to find a new voice, a humorist and a tragedian. Here he is.
Climate change. You ask me what winter was like in the old days, but I say, ask the chickadee whose energy budget is so tight, he told me this himself, if he so much as moves at night, he may starve to death by morning.
Ed Zonizer, he is known for the compressed poem, for the paradox, and for the twist of language. In fact, there is someone coming to the library as the new poet laureate who specializes in just these things. Kay Ryan would love your work, Ed. Let's hear some more.
Okay. This is from a series of poems whose titles begin, I want to quit my day job. I want to quit my day job and bus tables at a fern bar where the waitstaff share tips and you get free meals like avocado bean sprout sandwiches made with stone ground whole wheat flour and the germ gets dumped back in after sifting. On my breaks, I want to sit out where I can watch the patrons pretending I'm Marcel Proust, imagining their lives in far greater detail than they can find time to live them. I want to overhear toe-curling conversations, then turn them into instant myth like Jack Kerouac. Only I don't want to have to keyboard them, which is one of the main reasons I want to quit my day job and bust tables at a fern bar.
That is Ed Zonizer. And is this a new manuscript?
It's a mix. A lot of new things and some things from, even some things from my mother's archive, which I went through recently.
Oh, your mother's archive. Ed's books of poetry are The Way to Heron Mountain, A Calendar of Worship and Other Poems, and Mall Hopping with the Great I Am, Somondoco Press. So that was the last book in 2006, and that was pretty tightly formed. Those poems, you're pretty well known for being a formal poet.
Right. They're in the Berryman stanza of the 3 6-line stanzas with various rhyme scheme and metrical foot.
And this manuscript, does this digress from that?
My recent things have been mostly open form, yes, and I've been working with a different sort of more conversational voice, perhaps. But I still do, I stick in sonnets and things here and there.
Just... You sure do. And I've seen you in a workshop where you took an ing off a word and made it better. You are the best judge and best critic to have in a group of other poets. Ed, read us some more poems because I really want to hear the flavor and taste of this new work.
Well, this is not one of the newer ones, but it's called Stalking My Shadow. I flaunt secret stuff to my shadow, beat into submission decades gone. I try to shake my demons, but see my angels moving on. The world is ambiguous and not so safe as I once thought. Tongues turn out forked, and even parents polyglot. Skies loom, only looking blue, Winds you cannot see may not be spirit. The quiet I once bathed my soul in grows so silent now I fear it.
Does that come easily to you, the schema?
The schema. Well, that did. That was a tape recorder poem while I was wheeling one of the kids, this was many years ago, in a stroller. And I just got the first line, and I had my pocket tape recorder with me. And so I got enough of them down so I could remember it. But that was a poem that came out of a lot of work on the shadow.
Well, philosophically, how does form hold your art? What would it be like without form? I mean, you depend on scheme to hold your emotions.
Well, sometimes, in that case, I'd say, yes, the form holds the emotion. But generally, what intrigues me about form is where it takes you that you wouldn't, you just would not go there were you not looking for something within the form. So that's what I value about form. And that's why I never give it up entirely. I mean, even when I'm working in a different voice, I try to stick with the form because it shows me things.
Oh, can you give us an example of that?
Well, I'll read you a poem from my book, Mall Hopping with the Great I Am. And these were a series of poems I was trying to write every day. And so sometimes you sit down and never know what's going on, what you're going to write about. But the form takes you places. So this is called My First Career Counseling Session. And God does most of the talking in these mall-hopping poems. My first career counseling session. You talk too plain for prophecy, God said. Suburban death mindsets crave metaphor, the figurative stuff that startles back the living dead. Or what is poetry for? I must admit I couldn't answer that. My pose was to wear a Whitman-esque hat. God laughed. Well, at least that's truly felt. Why not a long white dress, too, like Emily D., gathered at the waist with a curtain cord belt? You could speak exclusively to future degeneracy by hiding your corpus in a bureau drawer. Or what is poetry for? Mm. Your post-war alcoholic manic depressives managed prophetic diction and almost sounded wise before. True compulsive obsessives, they dropped suicidal like kamikaze flies. I knew by then what poetry's for. It keeps me crazy and my family poor.
Do you always have a rhymed couplet at the end of those?
Not always, no. In fact, the rhyme scheme is sometimes so spread out it's not really orally noticeable by poets who aren't listening for the...
I applaud that. If we can't see the lumps, they're not there.
Right, well, Berryman, who's one of my favorite poets, he stressed the fact that you get energy from enjambment, from reading lines through and not end stopping them all. So that helps hide rhyme, too.
Tell people what enjambment is.
Well, enjambment is when you don't stop at the end of a line with any kind of punctuation, but read right through to the next word in the next line. That's called enjambment. Jamming is French for leg. Jam is French for leg.
Oh.
And it's sort of, it's the metaphor of motion, of moving on through it.
Oh, I am glad I asked. Berryman is known to be very self-indulgent and confessional, and you are not at all. So you have taken the template, but not the intent. Do you agree?
Yeah, what first impressed me so much about Berryman was, and this was before he came out with his later poems that were overtly religious, but in Berryman's masterwork, The Dream Songs, which is 384 of these dream songs in this stanza form, he manages a lot of religious content. Even if it's a theology of doubt, it's a religious content in a very modern diction. And the modern diction is woven in with highly poetic diction. And to me, it was just the apt modern voice, and well, that's what got me.
I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you reminded me that it's exactly what you do in your own work. It is known to be a form of spiritual leadership in your work. Let's have some more. Ed Sonheiser is here, and he lives in Shepherdstown, or is it Harper's Ferry?
Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
West Virginia. And he's with the National Park Service and has done some laudable writing for their own articles and their own beautiful books. What is the name of the one I just saw? About the wilderness, was it? What was the last book that you put together for the National Park Service?
That was about the National Park Service sites in the Virgin Islands. Most of those books were about single sites. Yosemite is one.
Yosemite.
Of, yeah.
Yosemite was yours.
That's a gorgeous book.
And you did the writing.
Yes, and I also was able to pre-select all the photos and work with the graphic designer.
That thing is
on laying it out.
Coffee table work of art. Thank you, Ed Sonheiser.
Well,
but here's
you.
The other side of Ed, poetry.
Right. Yeah, William Bronk's poems and thinking have interested me for a long time, and this poem, which is simply titled Poem, is obviously under William Bronk's influence. What we know is just as stuck in time as we are, and only true if all else we know is true as well. No wonder Thoreau said, the wild saves the world. First things keep our edge so we don't fall off it. Time being space and space time now, that first dance still here, whose womb we are within, without, knowing, being.
And another.
This is called Wedding Song. It's from an experiment in not doing language poetry, but doing poetry which is discrete lines which may not connect, but this is one of the best poems from that group, and it's because the lines do connect, so that's still not sure about the experiment. But this is called Wedding Song. There are no branching tree diagrams of how to love, and even some small children get it right. Nor is it rocket science, nor even esoterica. You just sort of stick your head in the door. Then no matter what happens, you don't leave. You keep on making dreams come true as hair falls out. Love permeates the classic canon and pulp fiction too, not to mention women's studies and opera or those looks the waitstaff get on every shift, because love can be confused with other needs, and notice that says needs, not wants, which sometimes only therapists can rearrange, whereas most priests or pastors numbly fidget. Nevertheless, I believe in love, don't you?
I like mostly that you say that you're never sure about the experiment. That's a good thing about poets, right?
Oh, right. And what appeals to me about poetry is that you always have to be learning it. You know, I mean, the idea is like Robert Graves said something about the perfect poem couldn't exist because, you know, the world would explode or something. But poetry is a constant learning, and that's what I love about it.
And you are one of the most scholarly people I know on poetry. I find you to be an authority on most of the poets. I might throw out a fishhook once in a while to get a question answered on email, and you come forth with chapter and verse about whether it's Bukowski or whoever I need to hear about. So you have a huge body of knowledge, and yet you have chosen not to teach in that field.
No, it's just been my, you know, my passion has been literature, and that's what I studied in college, but I have mainly always worked as a writer and editor in fields related to conservation.
And he is the senior writer and editor for the publications group of the National Park Service, which is located in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. And he speaks on wilderness preservation topics across the United States, has lectured at West Virginia University, Shepherd University, Cornell, Vassar. And I need to move into the world of your father and mother whenever you're ready. Would you like to take that journey with me now, or do you want to have another poem first?
I'd be glad to take that journey.
I'll tell you why. Most poets I hear who are men who write chiefly about longing to find their father. In your work and in your life, you have a lot of father. Your father was a predominant, huge, great influence on your life. And I am very touched by the homage you pay him and what he's done for you. I wonder if you'd just like to speak a little bit about his work, because I know you have done some publication there.
Yes, my father is considered the primary author of the Wilderness Act, which created the National Wilderness Preservation System, which now protects 107 million acres of public lands in the United States. And he was interested in literature. He had a collection of poetry and drama in the living room, about 2,000 volumes just in the living room. His natural history-related books are now in the Denver Public Library and collection there. And, well, in 1962, he got me out of my high school classes 3 afternoons in a row to come here to the Library of Congress for the 50th anniversary of the poetry magazine. And Robert Frost was there. He wasn't reading, but one day he sat right in front of us, and we could hear the stage, not only from the stage, but also through Robert Frost's amplifier for his ear that he was holding up. And W.D. Snodgrass was a brand new poet then, read his Phi Beta Kappa poem, and Randall Jarrell was there, and Gwendolyn Brooks. It was just 3 days of poet after poet after poet. So yeah, he was a big influence. And my mother made possible so much of our outdoor life, which included, in the summer of 1956, we did 10 weeks of wilderness trips connected by car camping. And
how many children?
4, and my parents, all in a Oldsmobile convertible with all our gear for camping and cooking. And, you know, there was no dehydrated foods then and whisper light stoves. This was cooking over open fires. So, yeah, they were. And we just did a book for my mother's 90th birthday of her 56th journal, her 1956 journal, that trip. And it's a very interesting book.
What does that mean, we just did a book?
We just turned my mother's 1956 journal of the Western Trips into a book for her 90th birthday.
Is she a well person?
June. Yeah, she's in good shape.
Did she remember? Did she look at it and remember what she had written?
Oh, my. Yeah.
Was she honored?
Oh, yeah.
So you have done a lot in your life to give back to your parents.
Oh, and tried.
You do, actually, I think you were instrumental in some of your father's writings as well. Where Wilderness Preservation Began, Adirondack Writings of Howard Zionizer.
Yes, my father didn't leave behind a book, which unlike, you know, Muir wrote a shelf of books, and Aldo Leopold wrote a book which was slow catching on, but established him as a conservationist. And a friend of my father's was pressuring me to write a biography, but I'm not a biographer. So I collected my father's Adirondack writings and some pieces about him by other people, and in that book, Where Wilderness Preservation Began. And I was glad I did it, because in my travels for wilderness speaking, I met a number of people who really came into their careers through that.
So. Knew him. So you
through the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my father died in 1964.
May each child give to their ancestry what you have given to yours.
Thank you.
Ed Zionizer is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and Ed has so many faceted in his life and work and what he's done for the National Park Service and what he's done in the service of his soul for other people. I'd love to hear some more.
Deconstructing Ohio with a Q-tip. The road flat frog looked like a map of Ohio, but see-through. Its overlay of highways, 2D frog guts like printed circuits, which was great. For years we'd wondered, what's Ohio like beneath? Solid, we say, compared to the edge of the universe, which expands, but not as fast as the costs of healthcare, higher education, and the euro against downward dollars, or the breasts of whoever hopes to replace Anna Nicole Smith or Dolly Parton, who waits in the wings to play herself in Madame Tussauds' wax museum. Sorry to steal your Anna Nicole Smith there. This next poem is called Love in the Time of Cholesterol. An epigraph is from Peter J. Shippey. Let's roll me toward. Let's talk, talk. I saw TV ads of what my arteries looked like with ping pong balls floating through them despite the lack of any apparent blood. Some of the yellow balls would stop to commune with my artery sidewalls while the audio of the TV ad exuded gobs of exhortation and incantatory repetition meant to make a guide to conduct out of hot air. So I gave up ice cream for the 40 days of lentils, imagining Jesus calling dead Lazarus from his tomb only to have him see his shadow like Dr. Phil, no, not the one from Punxsutawney, was to Oprah before he got his own show whose vague suspicions solid facts, unleashed rants, even Jerry Springer's biggest bouncers couldn't control, until I can't even remember now who Endymion was, amidst the charred ruin of Dr. Phil's brittle darts that pulled apart in three places like ballpoint pens fired into being by the madness of the gods, watching silence in the desert keep switching places. Until I wake up fondling my own breasts, augmented now by prostate drugs who collude with my blood meds, the utter range of noun and implied action lacking to render sexual love like solo stints on Staten Island.
Whoa, solo stints on Staten Island. Is that in verse and stanza?
No.
Oh, that's a, would it be a prose poem?
Oh, no, I mean, it's not in a form. It's just
a narrative.
Right. Most of my poems are the width of the notebook page I'm writing them in.
I was listening to try to see the form from that, and I thought it was so intense. With you always line up so many like words that it's almost like Galway Kinnell's early poems where he hyphenated so many words in a row to get that intensity. And I was just imagining what it looked like on the page, and I didn't see stanzas.
No, mm-hmm. It's not. It's open form.
Well, then you talk it the way you walk it. It's working.
Right. Well, I think I really picked up on Richard Hugo's suggestion that successions of strong single syllable words are, you know, are a good way to get energy.
Boom. Right. Since everyone is seeing you as a formidable figure in poetry, I want them to see a little bit of how you work. This is a man who, I don't know how many years, sat at Betty's Cafe at 6 o'clock in the morning while everybody, the truck drivers, were coming in and going out with their styrofoam cups. And there he sat in the back booth writing. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I wrote there for many, many years.
Did you buy anything?
Oh, yeah. Right. I had coffee every day.
That was good. Yeah. And but you went to work after that?
Yes. Well, at that time, my kids were young and sleeping till 7 o'clock, so I went down there and wrote from 6 to 7 and went home and got them breakfast and prepared to go off to school because my wife, Christine Duell, is a night person and I'm a morning person. So
we all should say Christine is a therapist, a very respectable practitioner of therapy. And does she look at your work and have any, does she bring her scientific and clinical feel to the work, or does she just appreciate it?
Well, actually, her background is academically is comparative literature, and she was a creative writer, won a couple of awards at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when she was up there studying. And so she can bring much more than science to my work sometimes, but she reads some of it, but not all of it, because there's a lot of it, and, you know, she has a life, too.
Okay,
but here's one she
some
wrote
of your life.
Here's one, actually, she wrote at the bottom, I like, with an exclamation point. This is called The Wild Blue Yonder. The wild blue yonder isn't blue, but its pure yonderness colors your imagination the same way as a crow flies, paints unseen distance and airy black, and helps you grasp how you will never reach the true beyond with ordinary waking consciousness, unless you fall in love and are transported there by the sort of trust and hope that means you will never ever again look over your shoulder to verify your own uncertainty, or, if you are male, to ask directions.
Do I remember correctly that you, I know that you're a man who goes to church and does find nourishment in that service every week. Do I remember that you used to write a poem after church every Sunday? Or is that something I imagine?
Well, back in my Betty's restaurant days, I was writing the major part of a book on trees for the Reader's Digest Trade Books Division. So I had to do that every day, but I didn't want to give up poetry. So I just decided that every Monday morning I would write a poem about the Sunday service and the community. And that's what that book, The Calendar of Worship, is. It's a collection of those poems.
Calendar of Worship. Right. And how can people get that?
They'd have to
go to a bookstore
email
and ask.
Me. No, I have the only few copies left of that.
Okay, they can get in touch with me and I can get in touch with you. I think it's worth having. So it's a limited edition.
It's very limited now, right?
Okay, here's Ed Zonheiser.
Nuns used to look like big penguins. Nuns used to look like big penguins. How did you get here? I asked her. I followed the white rabbit down the hole. Did she know she was standing on my coffin? I wasn't about to say anything for fear I'd get my knuckles wrapped with her ruler. Most nuns are mostly incognito now, except for how their shoes look orthopedic.
Let's hear one more of those.
Okay, this is a poem, You Look Stunning in Umpire Gear. Gertrude Stein was on third base with two outs in the top of the ninth and two strikes on the cleanup batter. Okay, she joked, let's hear some infield chatter. It was late in the season and unseasonably cold. Maybe it's just your teeth, she yelled. What nobody else knew was that under all that umpire gear, it was Alice B. Toklas herself. To fix a sentence is one thing. To fix a baseball game is another. But no matter, Dusty Rhodes took one ball, then hit a grand slam home run. Gertrude Stein walked to home plate, not so much to rub it in as just to say she did. Later, she confided to Alice B. Toklas, you look stunning in umpire gear.
Ed Zonheiser, let's have a final poem.
This is Bob Evans' sonnet. My wife, when we do road trips, likes to stop occasionally at Bob Evans for comfort food. So I try to write a sonnet, or at least get one started on the placemat whenever we eat at Bob Evans. At Bob Evans' restaurant. At Bob Evans, the music's more avant-garde than at Cracker Barrel, where the merchandise overwhelms your taste for biscuits cum laude before you reach the dining room door. Wise folk buy hard candies, climb back in their car, and slide back onto the interstate. At Bob's, the pies stare at you, goodies in a jar, the hostess lectern. Ergo, nothing robs you of your big hunger so long as it's for food. Decor, layout, nothing disconcertingly new. Would someone notice, dear, if we dined nude? Even waitstaffs, unchanged too, the menu, and the coffee, hot. Their bottomless cup sounds just great until you pick it up.
That is the voice of Ed Zonheiser, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin of M.E.T. Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. The series is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.